What's going on, everybody? Your boy, Big Dave, right here on another episode of The Bog. Every single Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern here on the Dave Martell channel. Like, subscribe, share, do all that good stuff. And then you can catch us every single Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern. We have a really, really awesome guest tonight, which we're going to introduce here in a second. But don't go anywhere. At the end of the show, we have another segment from our boy, the Folkish Farmer. At the middle, we have Primordial Strength with Mr. Jack Young. He's going to give us some workout techniques. Folkish Farmer is going to bring us some practical wisdom. And, oh, man, I can't wait. It's going to be really, really good. I can't wait to see what they got for us. But before we get started, like always, I'm going to give a shout-out to my homegirl, Ms. Hannah, at Traditional Apothecary. You guys know, stop giving your money to the multinational globalist vampires that hate your guts, sell you poison, plastic, synthetics, all kinds of weird stuff, trashes your hair, trashes your body, trashes your skin. Man, get some of this stuff. I swear. Get some beard oil, some hair conditioner, some lotion. It's really, really, really great. So stop giving your money to the people that hate your guts. Give your money to somebody that loves you and makes great organic products from the earth. I use it. My wife uses it. Dr. G uses it. Focus Farmer uses it. Everybody uses it. Everybody loves it. TraditionalApothecary.BigCartel.com. Promo code Dave. With me tonight, I have, like always, my co-host, Mr. Tristan. And then we have the author of Odin's Wife, William Reeves. This is such an excellent book. I can't wait to get started talking about this. Mr. Reeves is a member of the Neurona Society. Really, really brilliant man. You guys are going to absolutely love it. So how are we doing tonight, fellas? How are we doing tonight, Mr. Tristan? It's been a minute.
It has. Coming back for the holidays now. I'm doing pretty good, Dave.
Wonderful, wonderful. And Mr. William Reeves, how are we doing tonight, sir?
Doing good. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. My pleasure, sir. It's a long time coming. So let's get started here. So Odin's Wife. Tell us about what was your motivation to write this book here, and give us a quick overview of what's in this bad boy.
Right. Tell us a little bit. Who are you personally first?
Okay. I'm the webmaster at GermanicMythology.com. I've had a lifelong interest in Old Norse mythology and religion. I think most people who know me know that I started studying Victor Rydberg's approach to mythology. That led to me finding and translating the second volume of his work into English, and just extensively looking into the source documentation of Old Norse and Germanic religion. That's pretty much what I've done as a hobby. I don't have any professional training in this, but I've been doing it for probably 30 years or so.
Fooled me. After reading this thing, this is better than anything comes out of any university or any sort of official academic. I got to tell you, man, I thought you were going to say, oh, I'm PhD and this, that, blah, blah. Yeah, you really fooled me.
Well, I don't want to misrepresent my education at all. And this was truly a labor of love. It's something there's so much more in our sources than people realize. There's a lot of things that are just not discussed and not seen by people because of the approaches they take.
Yeah, so, you know, that's a good point, because I always see people who, you know, especially in apologetic circles or with discussions with other religious people, that they often have a very shallow view of our faith and all of the different scholarship that could go into it. They think there, you know, there's, at some people think we barely have any sources, or that there's just fragmentary remnants left, or you know, that everything was written sort of like the Irish tales, just, you know, scattered mentions by Christian priests. But that's really not the case.
Not at all. We literally have about 35 old heathen poems, the Eddic poems, and they appear to be composed by heathens within the heathen era. And there is some debate on that, but in general, they appear to be authentic heathen compositions. Mm-hmm. So I can't say it's rare, but we're one of the few cultures that has a detailed mythology.
Yeah.
You know, like you mentioned the Irish, it's, you know, it's much more fragmentary than ours is, and much later. So it's not preserved as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I started doing some look into like Konung's book and just like the parts that make up the Poetic Edda and stuff like that, and where they found it and where it comes from, and them looking into the language of the book itself. Now, it was written in Latin script, which means somebody that spoke Latin wrote it down, probably a monk or something like that. But as far as the stories themselves in the style of the language, it's all the experts, not all the experts, but many, many really good experts agree that it is an authentic heathen source. And it is from, at least the stories themselves are from ancient times. And even our good buddy Keith Osgood, that's from the Nirona Society, believes that some of these stories go back really, really far. He thinks like maybe even like Stone Age kind of stuff. And that he believes that some of the language and stuff correlates with like the Vedic tradition and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. What I show in my book in that first chapter called The Prehistoric Context, mm-hmm. I show that the area of Scandinavian and Northern Europe has been a cultural unit with a shared religious tradition, which is recognizable through their symbols and, you know, artifacts that have been left. And it was pretty much a cultural unit that existed for quite a long time. And then when you look at the literature, you know, the historic accounts, stories, things like that, you can extend this for about 1,000-year period. I don't think that the religion remained static, but I also don't think that it changed rapidly and radically. I don't believe that different groups in different areas had completely different religious traditions, only loosely related. That seems to be the common scholarly approach today. It looks like they were much more homogeneous in their religious beliefs with local variations, emphasis on a particular god or goddess or group of gods or goddesses. And we have to remember that when we're looking at these things, we're seeing small snapshots in time of religious practices and views, and usually given to us through people who are hostile to it. So we don't have a complete picture. That's when people say our sources are fragmentary. That's true, but we have a lot more primary literature in the Eddic poems than a lot of other cultures have. So in that, we're blessed in that sense.
And I believe in going into like kind of like the epic method and stuff like that, because this ties into, as far as the stories being supposedly fragmented, the epic method is to take these pieces, because Victor Rydberg saw that these pieces were all part of a coherent, like linear, epic, right?
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about, what are the different types of scholarship going on at the time when Rydberg was looking into it, and how did he develop the epic method? What are the principles of it?
Give us a brief
overview for people.
Yeah, but I'll try to be as brief as possible. The two prominent schools at the time that Rydberg was writing, and this is in about the 1880s, that's when he first got involved in this. There were two prominent schools, one being the nature school, which saw the gods as just symbolic representations of natural events, including, like human psychological, not just weather events, in other words, but, things that occur naturally. And myths, in some regard, can be interpreted that way. That is a function of the symbolic level. But that's not the only interpretation. The other more prominent interpretation was that the quote Viking mythology had developed through the Vikings having contact with Christianity in Ireland, and I believe that there was a colony of Irish monks, if I'm not mistaken, that first settled Iceland around the 800s. So that was supposed to be seen as the conduit for classical and biblical ideas being introduced to the Vikings, and then they reworked it into these fantastic mythological stories. So therefore, the story of Christ is our story of Balder. Odin hanging on the world tree is Christ hanging on the cross. It doesn't make a lot of sense when you start looking at it. Like in that example I just gave, Christ is identified as Balder and with Odin in two different instances. So yeah. It's just very piecemeal and very disorganized. In Rydberg's time, there was a popular theory. It was a guy who went on to become a bishop, so he was a clergyman, named A.C. Bang, and he wrote a paper that said that Voluspa was derived from the Roman Christian Sibylline prophecies. And Rydberg, who was, he was a biblical scholar, he was the first modern Bible critic in Scandinavia. He's acknowledged as being, and he wrote a book very critical of the Lutheran doctrine in the church. It was very controversial. So when this theory arose, scholars who believed that the mythology was native turned to Rydberg and said, is this true? What can you do? So Rydberg initially intended to write a paper about Voluspa in comparison with the Sibylline prophecies. And he proved that they were completely different and unrelated sources. And in his, this led to his first volume, The Investigations into Germanic Mythology. As he investigated, first starting with the poem Voluspa, he saw that chronological order of events. Voluspa mm-hmm. speaks of events unfolding from the beginning of time until the end of time in a chronological order. And that led him into studying some of these cryptic references in Voluspa to understand what they meant. And that led him to the realization that all of the myths, all of the poems behind the scenes have this idea of a chronological history of the world. So all of these were what were considered to be loose myths fit into a chronological timeline of events. And it's a history of our people. And in the first reference to a mythological cycle, Tacitus in Germania says that the only record that the Germans have, and the Germans include the Scandinavians in his, he calls them the Germani.
We would refer to it as the Germanic people.
Yes. So the Germanic people, the Germanic tribes, including the people of Scandinavia, the only record of their history were these popular songs that they sung. Well, these songs, the remnants we seem to have of them are the Eddic poems. And they're notoriously difficult to date because they seem to have layered on material over literally centuries. So another words, what we have here is a history of our people. It's the mythological history of our people. Like the Bible tells the history of the Jews from the beginning, the creation up to modern times. Mm-hmm. The Edda tells the history of the Norse people, the Nordic people, from their creation through to Ragnarok. So,
I would note that it was actually very common for the Indo-European people to record history and mythic history in song format. For instance, yes. The famous example of the Iliad, the great siege of Troy and Achilles and Hector and all that, that was originally composed as a song that people would sing. And they had like what we would call skaldic verse kennings and mnemonics that would help them to remember exactly which goes where and how to say it, how to memorize certain passages and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So very, very few of our poems speak of a chronological history, like Voluspa does. A poem like Skirner's Mall tells a story, but it has temporal references in it to events that must occur before and after it. For example, in Skirner's Mall 21, it talks about Skirner, who's the god Freyr's servant, is courting a giantess for him named Gerd, and he brings her gifts in order that she'll marry Freyr. And the first thing he offers is the ring Draupnir, and he says that this is the ring that was burned on Baldur's breast. So that tells us that Freyr's marriage to Gerd must take place after Baldur died and after Hermod traveled to the lower world and brought the ring back.
Wow.
So there's no reason for things like that to be embedded in the poems unless there was some concept of an order of events. And again, in Voluspa, we see such an order of events. So we know that the mythology was seen as a history.
So scholars
don't recognize that, though. That's where the epic method comes in. When we look at it, when we take that approach, we see the myths in a completely different way than the scholars do. And it not only is it just an approach, but I mean, our documents bear that out. We have examples in the mythology of those things, and they're consistent. That tells me it's correct, is because of the consistency.
So to be clear, though, you mentioned about essentially euhemerism and nature school and some of that stuff early on, and how it was kind of like you mentioned the biblical school of thought. So what you're saying is that, you know, these supposed monks that, you know, created this Nordic poetry out of biblical stories, like how Baldur is Jesus and Odin is Jesus and everybody's Jesus. You completely reject that. You say that the epic poems, the Eddic poems, are indeed an ancient, authentic heathen source. And not only are they heathen source, but all these stories that were fragmented are of a chronological order, and you can empirically prove that conclusively.
I believe so. I mean, when you say empirically and conclusively, we have to remember that this is mainly literary evidence, and you can use a body of literature to prove whatever you want. The issue to me is your theory consistent with all of the data? And when you find major problems, when you don't see consistency in the theory, to me, that's where it goes awry. And in this particular theory, it's consistent.
I often have difficulty explaining to people who aren't particularly familiar with the ins and outs of the liberal arts and academia in general that when you say that a theory can be proved, it's not like it is in math, where it is actually empirically provable, or chemistry, in which you can physically test a thing. When we say that you know, like, for instance, this academic literary theory is true, it mostly means that as much as anyone can see that we don't have anything that can be shown to contradict with it in any major sense, and that most experts would agree that it is probably correct.
I agree with most of that. I was an English major, and there's a expression that you can use Shakespeare and the Bible to prove anything. So in other words, you can take evidence out of Shakespeare to prove that he believed a certain thing, and you could take evidence out of Shakespeare's plays to prove he believed the opposite. And in the Bible, we see that among the various church denominations. You know, one group believes this, one group believes that, but they all have the same text. So a theory is only as good as the evidence presented for it. So you can... If someone presents a theory and it sounds good, but the evidence doesn't back it up, that doesn't make it a good theory. But the thing I took issue with is most people agree or scholars agree. The problem with this in Norse mythology is we have about as many opinions as there are people commenting on it. There is no consensus. Mm-hmm. There's consensus on some things, but there's a broad range of opinion.
Right. It does need to be mentioned that as a field, the idea of theological study into Norse history and whatnot is it's actually very, very young, and it's very fragmented as a field mm-hmm. of study. It really only took a place, you know, about 120 years ago. And then for grand political reasons that will not be named, it kind of dropped off the face of the earth for a while. And it's only really reappeared in modern times as something that, you know, is reputable and people would actually look into.
That's really a profound statement in a lot of ways. I don't think that people realize how young this research is. The mythology, of course, is old, but this mythology has not been known consistently since then. The Poetic Edda itself was rediscovered in 1643. About 50 years prior to that, Snorri's Edda was discovered, and it was only known among a very small group of scholars. And then after the Poetic Edda was discovered, it took almost about 150 years to come out with an academic edition of it. That was in the late 1700s, around the time of the American Revolution. And then in Northern Europe, I'd say probably about the beginning of the 1800s, you saw just slowly developing into, by the end of the century, an explosion in this study. And there's a lot of really good scholarship in the late 1800s, a lot of really good stuff. And then, as you mentioned, the unspeakable event, of course, is World War II, and all things German were pretty well seen as taboo. So people were not studying Germanic mythology after World War II. It came back around the 60s, but if you look at the scholarship of that time, I call it kind of the hippie period, there's a lot of wacky ideas that are being
right, that was spread. The rise of the New Age movement, which I'm sure everyone is familiar with the fruits of it today.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it there's a lot of wacky scholarship from that period, and a lot of the translations of the Edda through the 60s and 70s are pretty poor translations, actually, and they rework and they redo things. I just don't consider it good scholarship. But then, as you mentioned, we've had a resurgence of scholarship since about the late 1990s. Just excellent works of scholarship coming out of academia on all different aspects of the mythology and religion. But they approach it as though each individual area and culture and tribe had their own unique religion, only loosely related. And that's because of the various discrepancies and seeming contradictions in the popular concept of Norse mythology derived from Snorri's Edda. That's where all of this originates.
So you think you are what maybe I would call a pan-Germanicist.
I know that's a very controversial subject. It's really difficult to define because we don't have evidence from a lot of time periods and places. So I'm saying it's very important to know. We can't, for example, establish a Saxon religion because we don't have Saxon documents. We have Anglo-Saxon documents and we have other documents. But what we do know seems to point to being similar to what's in the Edda. And I think even people who see a separate Anglo-Saxon mythology acknowledge that. They just choose to highlight the differences between what they consider Saxon sources and other sources. The problem there, though, is those what they're calling Saxon sources are later and they're heavily Christianized. So how can you say that? How can you derive a pure type of mythology from there? I don't believe you can.
No.
I think you can do it from the Eddas. I really do.
And
poetic Edda.
We've talked about this before. We're about to come up on our halfway point and do a quick video, and then we're going to get into your book more. But I've been binge watching a lot of ancient battles kind of stuff. And we discussed this before in the Nerona forums about how the Germanic peoples of ancient times, didn't matter what tribe they were, very much viewed themselves as a single people, as one people. And a lot of people go as far as saying that even the Celtic people, the Irish people, viewed themselves as a similar tribe or folk as the mainland Germanics and so on and so forth. And going back to, I've been watching a lot of these ancient battles and stuff like that, everything from ancient Rome to the Holy Roman Empire, and something that I've been noticing ever since we had that conversation was there are so many battles that there's little videos I can't remember off the top of my head, but it'd be Charlemagne or Louis the Pious or one of the Roman Caesars or some whatever, they're fighting one of the Germanic tribes, and then out of nowhere some completely other separate Germanic tribe comes down from the northwest and attacks them from the other side, and it's like they're completely different tribes. Like, why are they both being called to go fight the same enemy? And it only makes sense is if all of these different tribes viewed themselves as one folk, one people.
Well, I mean, we actually have the word for a foreigner in old Germanic. It was the word Valha, and it's used in reference to refer to both the Celts and to Romans, and it can be contrasted to the words that eventually the Wael, which became for the Welsh, and also the word that became Slav for the Slavic people. So we can see the our ancestors had words for all of the different people around each other, but it's all with the implication that they don't have words for that's another Germanic person who is also a foreigner. They only have something like we would do today as that person who is not like us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's incredible.
That's what Tacitus says when he sees when he describes the Germans. They look different than the Romans, and describes that. So I do think people recognized, you know, people who are like them and people who are not like them. And the Germanic tribes, when you look at Tacitus, the first 27 chapters or so, might be a little off there, but about the first half of the book is what the Germanic tribes have in common. And then the rest of it is like a tour of Germania, talking about the beliefs and different traits of
the unique practices of each tribe.
Yeah. So it's, and Tacitus, from my studies, I don't think a lot of people realize this. He was not getting firsthand information out of Germania or traveling there himself. This is all piecemealed together from different reports. So,
I think principally it was from, I believe, his son-in-law. The person who married his daughter was stationed in Germania, and that's who he was getting most of the reports from, which we could probably assume is either things that he had seen personally, or he was also collecting information from his men, you know, the other legionaries in the area.
Yeah, there was also, this is what I in writing this book, I saw, and I don't have the exact information. Tacitus, somewhere in the annals, talks about one of his sources, and it's an encyclopedia of Germania from his time, but we do not have that work anymore, so we don't know what was in it, and there may have been other written sources and things that he's drawing on. So we don't know exactly what his sources were. Is really,
which is always the historian's paradox when they cite a work that we would love to have today, but we just apparently don't have anymore.
Yeah, and Tacitus himself was not found until about 1525, I think. So that wasn't known continuously since the ancient times either. That's something I think we need to really realize in the modern era. Like when people talk about having unbroken family traditions, we can't even show that in history. You know? Yeah. That's why I think most of us have trouble believing that, but that's one of the major reasons.
We have all come across that, you know, the 23-year-old Seth Kona who believes that all of her traditions stem from this unbroken line all the way back to the 400s or something.
And there's no way to know that. I mean, that's nice family lore, but that we just can't coincide that with our sources.
Yeah, that's incredible. All right, so we're gonna do a quick halftime show here. And we'll be right back in about a minute. We're going to hear from our boy, the mighty Mr. Jack Young. He's going to give us some workout tips. Yeah, here. So let's see what Mr. Jack Young has to say here.
Okay, so what's up, my folks and followers? Today I'm going to be showing you a chest dip. This is a great exercise. You're going to be working your pectorals, your deltoids, and your triceps, and your core. We'll also be stabilizing the whole movement. So I'm using gym equipment here. But you can also do this as a home exercise. If you have two sturdy chairs that are high enough, you can put them together and mimic the movement. So a dip is possible in the gym or at home. So approaching the bar, first piece of form to do is keep the shoulders retracted. So retract the scapula and bring the chest up high. That way you're going to get a big stretch in the pecs and really squeeze it when you come up. So coming in, keep the elbows semi-tucked. My feet are together, lifting up into the air. And coming down slowly, stretching out the pecs, pressing up. Okay, thanks for watching. This is just a really great exercise. Going to work on all your pushing muscles, make you appear bigger, stronger, more masculine. Keep killing it.
All right, so really, really cool stuff. Thank you, Mr. Jack Young. He's going to be popping in from time to time to give us some workout tips and helping us all get stronger physically and metaphysically. So shout out to Mr. Jack Young. Many blessings to him. Very awesome stuff. So let's get right into it here. Mr. William, Odin's wife. I want to tell you guys something here. This book is one of the best academic works that has ever come out of our faith. This crushes And I know Mr. William, he doesn't want to be put up on a pedestal, but I'm going to put him up there. This is top five best books regarding heathenry I've ever read in my entire life. And it's now become required reading for my kindred because our patron goddess is the All-Mother Frigg. This really put together a lot of stuff that I had floating around in my head throughout my life that he proved it and put it back together. So, Mr. William, tell us a little bit about the book Odin's Wife and tell us where we can find it and stuff like that.
Okay. I look at it as the first comprehensive study of Frigg in scholarly literature. There is no other study of Frigg. We have a study of Freyr. We have a study of Freya. There's scholars have written several books on Odin. Nobody has written a comprehensive book looking at all of the evidence surrounding the goddess Frigg. This is it. And I use firsthand sources. I give a lot of things in the original language, at least the pertinent passages, and in translation. I discuss them in detail. I apply all kinds of scholarship. I focused mainly on scholarship after about the year 2000. That was kind of I wanted to use what, quote, modern scholarship. So that's not always possible because there's a lot of really good scholarship over time. So I use the whole gamut of things, but it's a detailed study of the Earth Mother in Germanic mythology. And I believe that Frigg is Earth. She is the goddess Yord. After a thorough study of all of the evidence, I don't know how anyone else could draw a different conclusion. And I present all of the evidence. Let me just say this.
Can you give us a...
Just want to say, I present all of the evidence and I let the reader decide what, you know, if I've made the point or not. So that's really up. I don't want to tell someone what they have to believe or need to believe. Through my study and the evidence I presented, this is what I believe.
Very cool.
So can you give us a very brief overview real quick? Who is Frigg, Nerthus, and Yord for people who might not be familiar with these?
Okay. Nerthus is a goddess mentioned in Germania chapter 40. She's called Mother Earth and she rides in a wagon. And there's some other very specific details given about her in there. Frigg is traditionally Odin's wife. She first appears in literature in the history of the Lombards about, I think that's in the 700s, if I remember correctly. And Yord is seen as Earth, an Earth giantess, who is Thor's mother and a concubine or a fling of Odin's. She doesn't appear in any mythic source. She never makes a physical appearance in any source.
We just know her as the mother of Thor.
Yeah, pretty much. And she's in Skaldic poetry, she's called Odin's wife about three times more often than she's called Thor's mother. But because Snorri says that Yord's mother is Earth, we can't see her as anything other than, you know, she's this separate entity named Earth. When you study the poetic sources, that's not the conclusion that I would draw. It looks like it's just another name of Frigg. And in our mythology, the gods and multiple mythic objects are called by numerous names. That's a convention of our poetry.
We know that as a Skald game, it's called a kenning.
Heidi, I think is more, it's like another, it's an alternate name for something. So like we get these lists of names at the end of Snorri's Edda. They're called, I probably mispronouncing it, but the Nafnathulur, the name lists. And for example, we know that Odin has numerous names. Grimnarsmál tells us, it gives a list of numerous names at the end. Snorri gives us names and we find additional names of Odin in poetry. In the poems about Thor, he's called things like Hloridi and Vior, just as a normal name in there, but we know him as Thor, so there's no problem there. When we look at a poem like Rigstula, he's identified as Heimdall. So in our poetry, the gods are called by multiple names. And we generally know alternate names for most gods, but Frigg is almost an exception. We don't know alternate names for her, and she is the most prominent goddess and the oldest goddess in our literature. Why does she not have alternate names? And I would say that it's because Snorri doesn't tell us what those alternate names are. That's the problem.
Now, there's often a theory that the goddess Nerthis is a female counterpart to the god Njord, as a sort of his sister wife, as a sort of a parallel to the original relationship between their children, Freyr and Freya. Would you agree with this speculation?
I do, and the only caveat I make there is that I believe that Nerthis can be shown to be Frigg. So I do believe that she's Njord's sister wife, and there's three or four pieces of information in our primary sources, or some of our secondary sources as well, that point in that direction. I call it the theory of convergence. That's a term that Rydberg used, where we look at each of the pieces of evidence on a subject, like the Earth Goddess, and we look at the evidence, the details that are told, and we look for similarities. And we see, are there enough unique details said about Nerthis that are also said of Frigg or Njord to allow us to draw the conclusion that they were the same entity? And I believe that there are.
Wow. You know, I'm looking at, speaking about them being the same entity, I mean, you mentioned earlier, and we've been alluding to it, there are certain, like, I guess you could say, sects of people that believe that their regional name for their gods means that they're completely different gods. And, like, you know, for example, like, there's Saxon people that think that Votan or Woden is different than Odin for some reason. Like, that's the weirdest thing I've ever heard in my life. I'm just going to say that publicly. I'm not scared. But,
my explanation for that, Dave, I think that pagan groups are trying to distinguish themselves. It's a control. You know, our doctrine and our interpretation of the sources is more correct than yours, so we have to distinguish our Odin from your Odin. I really believe that's all that is. And it's based on this scholarly theory that there were different tribal religions in each area, only loosely related. There was a famous book by, I think it's Thomas Dubois, and it's named, it's like Germanic Religions, or I can't remember the exact title, but it's plural. So in other words, we don't have one Old Norse religion. We have multiple Old Norse religions. And the evidence doesn't support that because we don't have detailed enough information. We have little snapshots of information. You cannot draw a whole picture from that.
Yeah. But I've always rejected the notion myself on the basis that we have quite a bit of in-depth information about, for instance, the sagas and these people's lives, how they interacted with each other, how they were interacting diplomatically with other more distant kingdoms and petty kingdoms and tribal groupings. And we never see any sort of mention about, well, we went to war that one time because they said that Freya wasn't Ostara. And I mean, we just never see this, right? I mean, exactly. You would think if they had different religious ideals that this would be a common thing. I mean, it's a common thing in other parts of the world when you have different subsects of a religious or, you know, Christian schisms that are constantly feuding.
Yeah. One accusation that we get, like the Sedian movement gets, is that we're trying to create like a monolithic or like a monotheism, and we're trying to eliminate plurality and like stuff like that. And that's not, you know, that's not what we're doing at all. What we're doing is we're showing the evidence that, you know, there was a religious spiritual a consensus across the board, across the entirety of the folk. For the most part, there were foundations that everybody agreed upon, that it wasn't like, you know, this guy believes this and this guy believes that. It's just this willy-nilly, you know, orgy of made-up beliefs or whatever. Yeah, that's not what it was. You know, it's completely, it's like, it's, and what I wanted to bring up, what I was alluding to here, is I found a map, Mr. William, in your book here. It's on page 88. It shows Frau Hola, Frau Perscht. Here, I'll show you. And it shows the map of where they were all called. And just to give you guys, I'm not going to go through every single one, but the Frau Hola, and then in Frau Hola, and then Frau Herka, Frau Harka, Frau Freka, Frau Frick, Frau Goda, Frau Volda, yeah, Hulanda, Nehelania, Frau Verka, Frau Perscht, Frau Burst. It's like all the names sound exactly the same. It's just a different language. Like, who looked at this map and was like, oh yeah, these are all different people?
Yeah, well, they're similar. This was really the key to all of this. This is what convinced me. This map is based on a map by a scholar named Erika Timm, who wrote a book on the Frau Holle legends in Germany. It's a scholarly book published in the early 2000s. And she took a map and she put colored dots of every name of Frau Holle on a map. And what's important about this map when you look at it, I don't know how to say this well. The further north you go, her names become more and more like Odin or Odin's wife. Like Frau Goda just means Mrs. Odin. Frau Woda, Frau Woden is Mrs. Odin. Mm-hmm. Frau Frecka is Frigga, and it just means the beloved or love. It comes from the same, it's an old Indo-European root meaning love is where the name comes from. So that's why she's sometimes compared with Venus. And also because of the names of the days of the week. But we can recognize Odin's wife Frigga there and Mrs. Odin. And then in these other names like Hola and Holda, we recognize the name of Thor's mother, Hlodin, and an ancient Germanic goddess named Huldana, which is up there in the Netherlands. And then Frau Perkt and Frau Berkt. I think the name means light, if I'm not mistaken. Or bright, something along those lines. So when we look at these names, Frau Herka can be related to Ersi, Erka, in the Anglo-Saxon Acrobat. So when we look at these, they just are epithets of the same goddess. They have similar traits, but Frigga just means the beloved. Goda or Woda is her husband's name, so she's Mrs. Odin. Herka appears to be related to Ersi. Hola and Holden, like I said, is related to the name of the Earth Mother. And Perkt and Berkt means something like bright. So she's a bright, gracious, graceful, loving goddess. When you look at the various names, the meaning of the names, for example, when you look at Christianity, Christ is not called by one name. He's Jesus. He's Christ. He's Christ Jesus. Jesus Christ. He's the Lamb, the Son of God, Emmanuel. But they're all talking about the same person. We're told that those are the same people, so we understand that. Nobody told us that all these names are Odin's wife. But when we look at the Frau Holle legend specifically, we see that she is Odin's wife, and we recognize names of the Earth Goddess and ways to identify her as Odin's wife, Frigg. So it's crystal clear. This particular map shows that this is one goddess with multiple names over an area. And scholars recognize these various versions of Frau Holle as the same.
So I got a quick question here. Mm-hmm. I just got to get this out of my head because I've been recently getting bombarded with accusations and theories that Odin is a new god, that he came and maybe he was a Christian invention and the old the old king of the, I mean, we've heard all the Tyr Sky Father, and then we've heard that now it's coming out people have these theories that Uller was once the king of the gods and stuff like that. But if Odin is Frigg's husband, and we can prove that Frigg goes all the way back to Nerthus, then wouldn't that mean that Odin also goes all the way back to?
Well, I think that that's what the evidence shows. I don't believe that there was a god named Tiwaz. That's a scholar. It's a linguistic argument. There is no evidence for a god named Tiwaz. And if there was, I would say it was Odin and not Tyr. I could get in. That's chapter, I think, like 5 or 6 in the book. I won't get into the details on that. But when you look at the evidence in the northern Europe, since the beginning of the historic record, which is around the birth of Christ there. So, you know, Tacitus being one of the first prominent ones, we find that the god Mercury is prominent. And there's several sources that talk about Mercury being a prominent god among the Germans. And that's the Roman god Mercury. We know that Odin has no relation to Mercury. I get that. But the Romans identified this god that they found in Germania as their Mercury. And when we look at Odin and Mercury, there's a lot of superficial similarities.
I was going to mention that when you say that there's no relation. I mean, we know that, I mean, cognate-wise, they're not actually the same deity. But if you were an uneducated, you know, Roman at the time, you could if familiar with their mythology, you could look at what some people are telling you about Odin and come to the conclusion that, oh, this must be kind of like Mercury.
Mm-hmm. I think visually he looks like him, and they have superficial things like they both created the written language. They both are thieves. They both are conductors of the dead, things like that. So to a Roman saying that, you know, all gods are Roman gods, Odin looks most like Mercury to the Romans. And we see Mercury, statues of Mercury, and all kinds of evidence of worship of, quote, a Germanic god identified as the Roman Mercury all through the historic period. The Christian scholars, when they start coming online, I'd say probably about like 400, 500, 600 AD, they identify Mercury with Odin. And some people will say that's a late identification, but for the reasons I just gave, I believe it's accurate. And then Odin, the name Odin starts picking up. It first appears, I want to say, around 650, and then again in 700. Well, the first known appearance was down in Bavaria. So the theory in the late 1800s was that a local war god named Odin started in the south, moved his way north, and became the head of the pantheon. And the linguistic theory of Tyr, who's the only relationship that our god Tyr, the one-handed god Tyr, has with the Indo-European sky father, is half of his name. Tyr corresponds to Deus in the larger name Deus Pater, but Tyr has none of the characteristics of that sky father as he's reconstructed.
Right, and personally, I've always rejected the notion that Tyr was the sky father, and I think Tyr or Tiwaz as a sort of epithet is more of a title than even the god's name. His name mm-hmm. probably isn't even Tyr. We can see it in different. Yeah, we can see it in the different names of various other gods. I mean, Odin, the Hengatir, and all these other different names he has that have the epithet Tyr to it. It just meant at that time a god or a brave god.
Mm-hmm. What's weird, and I did not put it in the book, I had remembered reading it but didn't find it, is there's a passage in Snorri in Skaldskaparmál where he explains that, but he says that it's named after the god Tyr. So that's where that idea comes from, is directly out of Snorri. But as you said, the word Tyr also just is the common word for god. The plural is Tivar. And it's, we find it used in our own Eddic poetry.
Well, not only that, but we already have a past information about how we will refer to our gods as titles. For instance, both Freyr and Freya aren't their actual names. They're titles for lord and lady. His name is Yngvi. So we know this is something that our ancestors already did.
Yeah, it's the usual reason usual explanation given is that it's for taboo reasons. It's taboo to name the name, to invoke the god. So we use epithets. And eventually over time, those epithets tend to become proper names. So calling this god the Sky Father, referring to Odin, eventually one of these other names, like Wodinaz, becomes his proper name, and the original name is forgotten or becomes an epithet. So that, to me, that's the best explanation, because we see this continuous chain of, we see a very prominent god named Mercury who's identified with Odin. And then we find Odin first in Bavaria, but then 50 years later in Denmark. The next reference to Odin's name is in Denmark. So here it's already pan-Germanic. We find one in the south and one in the north of the region within 50 years of each other. I don't think that's a local tribal god becoming a pan-Germanic god in the space of about 400 or 500 years, because that's really what they're talking about. When you look at the timelines, could one local tribal god not worshipped by other god become a god of the top god of all those tribes, and then become the focus of the Eddic literature, become the king of the gods in the Eddic literature within the space of about 600 years total?
It's crazy.
I don't believe it's possible. So it's very important when looking at some of these scholarly theories to look at them in real space and time, and look at maps. How far apart were these things in time and in space? Because that's the part that people just kind of gloss over. When you look at that, things don't add up. And when you look at a map like the one that you were pointing out, Dave, mm-hmm. you see that you look back and you see the larger pattern. It's like we have this Earth mother with all these similar traits called by different names all over Germany. And this is only Germany. I'm sure this extended off into other areas. I only had data for Germany because of that book by Erica Tim. But, you know, if someone does a wider study and shows the, you know, she's called Frau Frecke in the Netherlands. And I'm sure when you get into Poland and the Czech Republic, you probably also have, you know, and in France and things, you probably have extra information.
Excellent.
I really hope that this book is a catalyst for people where they take the information in it and they take the research further. When I started this, I only had the piece of information that Rydberg had, that Nerthus is worshipped by the Lombards, and then in 100 AD in Tacitus's time, and then in the Lombard saga in 700, they're worshipping the goddess Frigg, who's Odin's wife. And it's, they're Christians at the time that tale is written down, and the author says it's a silly tale. A ridiculous fable is the actual words. It's a ridiculous fable told by old men. So this is an ancient myth among their people. It doesn't die even in Christian times because she gave them the name of their tribe through her help. And so they're worshiping Nerthus in 100 AD, and like 500-600 years later, they have an ancient story of their devotion to Odin's wife Frigg. And then we see that Frigg is an earth goddess. We're told that Nerthus is Mother Earth, so there's no question there. But then look at Frigg. Her most prominent story is Baldur's death. She commands all things to take an oath not to harm Baldur. The one thing she forgets is the thing that doesn't grow on the ground. It's a parasite that grows on trees. So she's the Earth Mother, and she forgets the one thing that grows, that doesn't grow in the ground, and that's the one thing that harms her son. And wow. The next thing she does is after Baldur dies, she gets all things to cry for Baldur to, so he can return. And it specifically says, if all things will weep as cold things do when they come in from the, or when they come into the heat, they weep. So I mean, you see the nature symbolism all through that myth. And yet, you know, she's called, in the poem Sona Torek, the gods are called Frigg's progeny, Frigg's children. But we only know that Frigg has the son Baldur, that's it. And Odin, the term Odin's wife in Skaldic poetry refers to the earth exclusively. When you say Odin's wife, you're referring to the physical earth in Skaldic poetry. Yet in Eddic poetry and in all other historical sources, when you talk about Frigg, she's Odin's wife. So there's something wrong with our modern interpretation that sees Frigg and Njord as two separate beings. And my book goes through the evidence for both. And then you can see where the modern theory comes from, which is directly out of Snorri's Edda. Snorri's trying to explain poetic passages in old poems that he probably has in written form. And he's trying to explain how to create this old type of poetry for Christians. So he has he's not faithful to the old mythology. He's trying to explain how to write this type of poetry, and he explains just enough of the mythology so you understand how to write kinnings and things. And it's not considered to be he didn't write it as a mythology book, in other words. It was considered a book of poetics, and then in the late 1500s, it was recognized as a book of mythology. And it was the first publication of it, it was presented as a series of fables, heavily edited. So all of his Christian explanations and Christian references were just removed. And then in the early translations from the 1800s and the early 1900s, the introduction to the book, which explains the Christian context of the Edda, was removed. So it just wasn't translated. So people tend to focus on the mythological aspects and they don't look at the work as a whole, where Snorri explains Norse mythology in the context of Christianity, and it distorts the mythology in serious ways. And that's what Rydberg really set out to do, was to separate what the sources say from Snorri's explanation of the sources.
Very cool. Very cool. So For the people out there, sometimes I also get the argument that the sources are written by Christians and a lot of people confuse that there's a difference between the prose and the poetic Edda. There is a huge difference.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
The poetic Edda predates Snorri, and it's written in poetry, and the poetic forms and the content are shared across the Germanic region. We have Anglo-Saxon poetry that speaks of some of the same subjects and uses the same verse forms. We have things like the Merseburg charm that shares poetic forms and verse, verse forms. And then these verse forms can be related back to other Indo-European verse forms and content as well. We can take, from Völuspá, for example, the creation of the world from the body of a giant that's been determined to be an Indo-European mytheme. So there's a lot of old, there's a lot of older mythology embedded in it. But once the Germans broke off and they became independent, the mythology continued to evolve. New stories were added on top of the old, and older stories were, changed somewhat. I wouldn't say radically, but they adapt to the times that they're in. And that what we have left in the Eddas is the remnants of that. We don't know what original form those were. We don't know if, like the poem Hávamál, for example, is at least three different poems or pieces of three different poems thrown together. We don't know what the original forms were. But the content isn't Christian. You don't find Christian references, Christian words, things like that in the poem. So there's really no reason to believe that the poems themselves have strong Christian influences or any Christian influence, really. It's completely debatable. Scholars still debate about that today, 130 years after Rydberg's time.
So you are saying it is conclusive that these are the poetic Edda. I believe we said this earlier, but I think this is it's important to reiterate this, that the poetic Edda is indeed an authentic ancestral pre-Christian text.
Well, yes, but we have to remember it's a collection of poems. So it's not scripture. It's not it's not a book. It's a collection of poems that were presented in oral fashion at one time. Tristan had given the example of Homer's Iliad and the Odyssey. Those were originally oral poems, and they probably took a little bit different form every time they were recited. And when we have two manuscripts of a poem like Völuspá, we see differences between the two manuscripts. Many similarities, but some differences. But both poems were written in a heathen context, so the information in them is mythically correct in both poems, but it wasn't presented the same way because these are not written scriptures. They didn't have that concept. It's an oral history of the world.
And one more thing I would like, because we are running out of time, I want to reiterate this, and this goes to the plurality argument. So would you say that There was indeed consensus about myth and maybe spiritual philosophy and understanding of the gods, and the plurality was in culture and language?
It's pretty broad, but yeah, I believe that there was a Germanic culture, and I'm sure there was some variation within it, but there was a Germanic culture and a Germanic history of the world, which was a mythic history. And mythology is just the stories of the gods' interaction with men over time. And we see that. We see the gods, their birth and development, and then we see them create men, and then we see what's really missing in our mythology, what we don't see so much, are the heroic stories. But there's a whole heroic epic of families, and it starts with Jarl, Kone, the son of Jarl in Rigsthula. That's the head of the human race, I guess, and it's the basis of the heroic stories. And Rydberg does a masterful job putting that stuff back together. He goes through the Germanic Helden book and the heroic poems in the Edda, and he shows the story arcs and the threads that go there, and they're very closely related to the mythology. So it is a history. It's a history.
Now, William, when you talk about, in the context of your own work, when you discuss the the Germanic mythology and the Germanic gods. Do you take the perspective that these deities are in fact actual beings that exist in a religious sense?
Yes, I see no reason not to. The gods are not spoken of as symbols or allegorical things. Yes, those things are embedded within the mythology. That's one level of interpretation, but there's many other levels. So Rydberg explained it in this way. He said that if the gods did develop from natural forces, like say Thor originally was the thunder, as soon as he was personified, he ceased to become the thunder because he now has human relationships, stories. He has a chronology. He was born. He gets married. He has children. You know, we have the story, of course.
No. I'm sorry, William. You misunderstood me slightly. Okay, I mean, sure. I don't mean that these people were considered to be personable. I mean, in the context of your work, do you believe that Odin is actually a deity that exists religiously? He is a god. And that it's not just a construction that humans have invented.
Of course. Yes,
right. Well, I mean, I want to make sure people know this so that because, of course, this is a debatable topic amongst some people in the community.
It really is. I agree with you. It
surprised. And I know it sounds sort of weird for anyone who is legitimately religious to have to say, yes, I'm religious. But here we are.
this is what surprises me is. People say that they're pagans, and yet they'll tell you that the gods aren't real. Well, what is it you're worshiping exactly?
Themselves. That's what they worship.
Apparently so. That's the issue. Because of this work, I've had to get into a lot of the philosophical background and the approaches, and that's one thing I really admired about Mark Puryear's work with the Noruna Society, is to unlearn this stuff, you really have to learn what it's made up of. These different approaches that scholars take, like the Euhemerism, like you mentioned, or the Christian perspective, all of these things still exist today, and all of them have affected our scholarship in one way or another. So when we look at the Eddic poems as truly heathen poems and start to study them in their original language, not in translation, but looking at what the words mean, and there's just so much more there. I still discover things in here, and I know there's so much more to be discovered. A book like this, I really want just to be a catalyst for people to look into the source documents themselves. Scholars put on their pants the same way you and I do. They're human beings. You can do the same research they do. The sources are available. And with the internet, you can look at a lot of the original documents and the manuscripts themselves now. When I first started this, you couldn't do that. So it just never ceases to amaze me, all the information that's out there. But you have to get away from the popular books that just have the regurgitated Snorri's Edda interpretation of the mythology, because that's what most of the popular books are.
I'll tell you, I've gotten to the point now that if the piece or the opinion or the work isn't written by a legitimate, authentic believer, I don't read it. I don't even.
Well,
you know what I mean? Outside of maybe Rydberg and some of the older guys, but anything now that is written now today, if it's not constructed by a believer, I don't trust that they have the philosophical or spiritual background to truly understand what they're writing.
Yeah, right, I'm not sure I would go that far myself, yeah, but it definitely needs to be approached with skepticism, you know?
Well, that's what you'll find in my book. I quote a lot of scholarship, and I do that on purpose. Scholars study this stuff. There's some very good Old Norse scholars. You just have to know what their approach is. Someone like Hilda Ellis Davidson, who's dead now, but I mention her because she's very popular and she has a lot of books out there that people are familiar with. She was a one great goddess, one great god person. She believed that all goddesses were aspects of one goddess. I don't believe that. In this book, I want to make that clear. I'm not trying to prove that all goddesses are one goddess or all Northern goddesses are Frigg. That's not true. Freya, Idun, Ir, there's many other goddesses. But we find in our literature an Earth Mother named consistently as Odin's wife. That's why I named the book that, because the one thing these have in common, the most common thing they have in common, is being Odin's wife. But she's the Earth and she's Odin's wife. And people have a hard time wrapping the idea around she's queen of heaven and Mother Earth, but that is what our mythology presents. I can give it. Well, actually, the book has lots of examples that support both of those, queen of heaven and Mother Earth. She's both.
And we got to shut it down. We're starting to run over. William, we could do like a whole another 2 hours. You know what I mean? And we'll save it for a part two and three, and we'll have you back on and stuff like that. But I do have one closing question, because and then we're going to talk about where people can find your book, and then we're going to finish up with Folkish Farmers video. But unless Mr. Tristan has anything in conclusion, I don't want to. Yeah.
No, I'm pretty good, actually.
All right. Very cool. So, Mr. William, this is actually part of Tristan's question, and I feel like we ask this a lot, and I think it's really important, because we're kind of like hammering down that this is an authentic tradition, a real religion. In your studies, in what you have found, you know, writing this book, and you know, actually, you also have a really great website. I believe it's called German Mythology, and I'll put that in the description. Would you say that our ancestors also, besides you or us, also viewed the ancient gods as real deities and not as just symbols or themselves or anything like that? Would you say that they viewed them as real deities that they observed and they feared and that they worshipped?
Yes, definitely. Not everyone, of course. We have examples of people who believe in their own might and main and don't trust in the gods. But yes, and they believe that the gods walked among us. There's many stories of Odin appearing in disguise among human beings. And that's a very common Indo-European theme, where the gods walk among us in disguise. We see that in the Iliad and the Odyssey as well. So yes, the gods were real physical beings that aided men, and men called on for help, men and women both. And the gods were a family. This is what's important about my book, is it restores Frigg to her rightful place. She is the mother of the gods. She's Odin's wife. In Sona Torek, the gods are called Frigg's progeny. Her children are Frey and Freya by her brother Njord. And by Odin, she has the sons Thor and the twins Balder and Hodr.
But not to be, I do want to clarify, when you mean gods that walked among us, they weren't like people, like euhemerism says. They weren't just great heroes that ascended to deity. They were real deities that had the power to manifest into physical form.
Yes, that had the power to control the weather, that had the power to take you on their horse to the underworld, that had the power to draw you up to heaven with them if they wanted to, or had the power. There are numerous stories of gods interacting with men in our mythology.
Very, very cool. Excellent.
And you'll see that in the book here. It's wonderful. You asked where you could get this. This is available pretty much wherever books are sold. It's available in hardcover, paperback, and in a Kindle version. The Kindle version has colored pictures. The book is heavily illustrated with classic illustrations. I just find an illustrated book to be more interesting to read. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. That's pretty much it. I just, if anyone wishes to contact me, they're welcome to do that. I have my email address in the back of the book, and I'm happy to field questions. I think this restores the balance in our Godhead. It's not just Odin as the All Father. It's Odin and Frigg. She is the All Mother. And I don't think there's any question about that. When people read the book, they will see the evidence for it. And I don't expect anyone to believe this firsthand. It contradicts information people think they know, like Thor's mother is Jord, and she's separate from Frigg. But just read it with an open mind and look at the evidence for yourself before you make up your mind. That's all I would ask.
As I said earlier in the show, we've been trying to get William on for a long time. We finally lined up our schedule and stuff like that, because this is a monumental work. This is truly a monumental book. And if you are Sedian, if you are Asatru, if you are just interested in old Germanic myth or the history of your people and stuff like that, this absolutely has to be on your bookshelf. This is a tremendous work, and I got mine from Amazon. You can get it on Amazon. You could also make sure to check out William's website, GermanMythology.com, I believe it's called, right?
It's Germanic, but an IC at the end of German. And if anyone's interested, if they go to my name on that site, I've got some essays. There's a section on Odin's wife, and I've got two chapters of the book, the Nerthus chapter and forget the other one, but there's two full chapters on there if anyone just wants a sample of the scholarship before they buy.
Absolutely, go check out his website too. It's just loaded with sources. He's got the PDF of every single page of the Poetic Edda in its authentic form. It's really he has a really awesome website. It's got archaeological find all kinds. We're gonna go all here all night. We gotta close it down, but GermanicMythology.com, Odin's Wife, available on Amazon. Make sure you check it out. William Reeves, Nerona Society. Make sure to go over to Nerona.org. Check out Mr. Tristan and Kerwin's website at Ari Akasha, the Ari Akasha Institute, which I link in the description every single time. Mr. Tristan, do we have anything in conclusion?
No, I think I'm pretty good, actually. Love to have William back again at some time, and we could discuss more about his theories.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mr. William, thank you so much for coming on, man. This was a wonderful, wonderful episode. I know everybody's going to love it. Mr. Tristan, thanks again, like always. And me and Tristan will be back here next week, next Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern with The Bog. Another great episode that you guys are going to absolutely love. Make sure you like, subscribe, share. I see you guys. I look at my analytics. I see how many of you guys are coming in from other sites and aren't subscribed. Subscribe right now, or I'm going to find where you live. Like, I have that technology. Like, you don't even know what Big Dave is capable of. I will come to your house. I will help myself to your food and your snacks, and I will sleep overnight. I will wash my clothes there. It'll be a nightmare. I will overstay my welcome. Don't think I won't. So
raiding is the most Indo-European of pastimes.
So make sure you subscribe here, Dave Martell, and we will be back next week, Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern. And like always, I'm going to give a shout-out to my homegirl, Miss Hannah, traditionalapothecary.bigcartel.com, link in the description. Man, stop giving your money to multinational globalist vampires that hate your guts. Give your money to something good. I'm telling you guys, this stuff is great. You guys don't even believe how many messages I get. They don't even want to talk about The Bog. They just want to talk about the lotion and the beard oil they got. It's like, I'm starting to feel some kind of way, but it's okay because it's really, really great stuff. I use it. My wife uses it. My mom uses it. Dr. G uses it. He's a doctor. He's a real, real doctor, and he uses it. He's a brilliant doctor. And then Focus Farmer uses it. And Focus Farmer, you guys already know, the guy's all about all kinds of organic, fresh stuff. So you guys are going to love it. TraditionalApothecary.BigCartel.com. Promo code Dave to get 10% off. Absolutely go there. Thank you, William Reeves. Thank you, Tristan. Tristan, much love. Many blessings to all you guys out there. And I'll see you guys next week here on The Bog. Let's hear from Focus Farmer on our way out. Hail.
Hello everyone and welcome to another edition of the Folkish Farmer. Today we're not in the kitchen, today we're outside. It's a nice December day. It's not super cold, which is nice, but what's interesting that I want to talk about is some of the things that you can do in the winter time to prepare for your summer gardening. And what I've got right here is roughly a quarter acre. It's a little bit less than a quarter acre, and the reason I want to talk about that is that the average American yard is about a quarter of an acre. And on this quarter of an acre I have 8 apple trees. I have over 300 garlic plants planted in between the apple trees. I have over here crops that will be ready in the springtime, or at least the soil will be ready in the springtime, so that I can put pumpkins and beans and various other vegetables in between the rows of trees. Now, so many people, after the Yule and after the Christmas time, they make all these New Year's resolutions that I'm going to get in the gym and I'm going to work out hard and I'm going to do all these wonderful things. The reality is that most people don't take these New Year's resolutions to completion. They're usually done within 6-7 weeks. And what's really bad about that is that they're not being productive with their time. Gardening is something that is not only productive, it's good for your family, it's good for your overall health as well. Plus, the vegetables you'll procure from this are a lot better than you're going to buy in the supermarket. When you think about going to the gym, you go to the gym to get exercise. We have a very sedentary lifestyle. And if you look at the exercise that you get from a gym versus what you're doing out here, hauling in the mulch, tilling the soil, putting the compost in, digging the holes, you roughly burn around 300 to 400 calories per hour. That's the same as playing basketball. That's the same as doing some of these Zumba and jump around classes, as I call them, and things. Now, what's nice about this is that the exercise that you get from this, you're also getting a secondary benefit. You're producing food. So one of the things that I want to talk to you guys about is for your New Year's resolutions, instead of going to the gym and getting your exercise there, why not get your exercise here in the garden? And the nice thing about this is if you're not a fan of garlic, which I am, you can plant onions or leeks or anything in between the apple trees because they have a symbiotic relationship with the apple trees. This is called companion planting, and this is something a lot of permaculturists will use so that it keeps away bugs and pestilence and different diseases. Other things like autumn olives that I have planted up here fix nitrogen to the soil. So that's really nice when I start to plant things like pumpkins and various things in between these rows, because they're going to get some of the natural benefits from this autumn olive. In addition to that, that's a fruit, and you can eat the fruit. It's not exactly the tastiest fruit on earth, but it does make good jams and preserves and things of that nature. So one of the biggest things that I would like for you guys to look at is learn a new skill. This year, I want everyone to learn a new skill, whether it be cooking, whether it be gardening, whether it be, you know, learning to weld, woodwork, whatever. And this is a great skill to learn. So throughout the year, I'm going to be showing you guys some different gardening techniques and different ways to cook the food that we produce from our garden. This is so beneficial to your overall lifestyle. And this is one of the most important things that you guys can learn how to do, is provide for your family. We'll also be talking about putting in some food plots as well. If you're an avid hunter and you want to kind of up your game and get more wildlife into the area, we're going to talk about food plots. We're going to talk about ways that we can attract animals in. Because in my opinion, raising livestock or hunting a wild animal is no different. You're still procuring the food. So one of the things that I like to do with some of the rougher areas of my land is seed a lot of food plots in there so that I can attract deer and bear and other wildlife. So this way, I have a steady food supply. The last thing I want to talk to you guys about is that if you notice, this is a hillside. This is the worst piece of land that you could probably want to farm. And that's perfectly fine. As long as you give the soil nutrients and you compost the soil, you take care of it, you put certain varieties of plants in to help the soil, you'll be able to grow things. So you don't have to have this ideal, perfect, flat piece of land. And this is certainly not ideal. The mud through here, the soil, is clay. It's terrible. But if you add enough compost and you take care of the soil, you'll be able to have things like garlic. This garlic was planted just a few weeks ago. You can see that the bulbs are overwintering and they're doing quite well. And I'm probably going to have at the end of the season probably about 150 pounds worth of garlic. That may seem really extreme, but when you start drying out garlic and making garlic granules and things like this to cook with, you end up with, let's say, always lacking for some more garlic. So one of the things that I encourage everyone to do is grow garlic. It's super simple, it's super easy, and it's expensive at the supermarket. There's a lot of varieties of garlic, and one of the interesting varieties that I grow is something called elephant. Elephant garlic is a cross between a leek and a garlic. It produces a much larger bulb, so it's easier to deal with. Looking over here at some of the other sections that I have, garlic works well also with the peach trees, and so in between the peach trees and around the base there, I'll plant garlic also. That helps keep a lot of the insect pestilences away. So this is really just not even a quarter of an acre, and it's going to produce so much food in the future. And that's what I want your guys' goal to be, is to produce as much food as you possibly can. Thanks, guys, and I'll be talking to you soon.